coming up on Weekend America.
This weekend, 40 years ago, the bath party took over.
It happened early in the morning. The radio came off, and the first thing they said was, "It is a white revolution. There will be no blood expelled."
We continue our series, This Weekend in 1968. I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm John Moe. This hour we'll take you to Glacier National Park, if we can find it.
We just came on a sign that says Granite Park Campground, 0.6 miles. And it's just pointing directly into a forest covered with snow.
And the Army apologizes for a 60-year-old mistake.
Now it all makes sense that this was something that he was carrying on his heart very heavy, and he carried it with him to his grave.
This weekend, the Army revisits the lynching at Fort Lawton. After the news.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, welcome to The Weekend. In St. Paul, I'm John Moe, in for Desiree Cooper.
And I'm Bill Radke in Los Angeles. This weekend in Connecticut, there is a Life is Good festival. But is life good? We will answer that conclusively later this hour. And coming to emergency rooms across America this weekend, people with fish hooks stuck in their bodies. We'll find out how to remove the barb, but, and this is important, John, leave the memories.
Okay.
What are you doing this weekend?
This weekend, I'm having a yard sale.
You know, I'm retired, and I just do what I want to do. I'll probably mow the yard.
We're going to a water park in Phoenix.
This weekend, I'm going to the Canyon County Fair on Saturday, and on Sunday, I'm up in a junior rodeo.
I'm actually driving up to Traverse City, a beautiful area in the northwest area of the state. You know, we're going to be cycling, visiting some of the great vineyards up there, and just having a fantastic little vacation.
This weekend, I plan on doing some whitewater rafting up at the Payette River, along with some camping, sitting in some hot springs, and drinking ice cold beer.
I was about to pat that guy in the back for being, you know, so active and getting so much exercise until he got to the beer.
Turns out he's just sitting. Yeah. Those voices came from Ann Arbor, Michigan, Boise, Idaho, and Norman, Oklahoma.
68 was like an earthquake.
The country was not on the cusp of revolution.
There appeared to be as many policemen as demonstrators.
But it was certainly on the cusp of some enormous millennial change.
We hear you loud and clear, boy.
It still does resonate even when people don't realize that it's resonating.
We've been bringing you a series called This Weekend in 1968. Now, 40 years ago, Iraq was involved in a military coup that brought the Ba'ath Party to power, an event that would have an impact on the U.S. for decades. Saddam Hussein's distant cousin, Ahmed Hassan al-Bakr, became president of Iraq. Saddam soon became vice president, and in 1979, Saddam pushed Bakr aside and took control. We spoke with Iraqis in the United States who remember the revolution, the years that followed, and their thoughts on the United States invasion of Iraq in 2003.
It happened early in the morning.
I was at my aunt's house, and we were still sleeping, and my uncle came, and he said, "There's a revolution." And, you know, Iraqis, they usually run to the radio.
Every time we have a coup attempt, this music comes.
But this one, 1968, we remember very well because it was a different kind of a revolution. It was called the White Revolution.
Really, there's nobody killed.
And they announced that it's the Ba'ath Party. A lot of people were so afraid.
My name is Nabil Rumaye, and I was in Baghdad, Iraq, in 68, a young man. But I have to take you back a few years to tell you why I remember that day. We knew what Ba'ath is. We saw them in 63. A very bloody coup. Thousands and thousands died. And my uncle, who was like in opposition to the Ba'ath, and he was imprisoned in the 63. My aunt was in prison. My sister was in prison. Me and my two sisters had to leave the house for about 9 months and hidden somewhere else. So, yeah, I was at home, basically, and I remember it because my uncle said, "Not again. Not one more. We cannot take this anymore." So he sat in the car, and he just drove out to try to get out of the country before they consolidated their power. About 8 hours later, he was back because they closed all the borders.
My name is Mona Suleiman. I lived in Baghdad until 2003. Saddam means clasher. You know, when you have a car crash, it's Saddam. So Saddam is the one who crashes or clashes. That's a very powerful name.
My name is Leila Abdelghani, and I'm a social worker. We've been here in the United States 26 years. Not everything that government did was bad. I mean, they nationalized the oil. Art and literature became very important, and free education, free health care. I mean, these are good things that revolution brought to the country.
Americans think that we used to live in horror, terror. I mean, you know, like he goes out, he sends his people, and he kills left and right. But we were trained since we were children, and we train our children also not to interfere with politics, not to say anything against him. If you want to live a good life, don't meddle in politics.
There was a lot of struggle inside the Ba'ath Party to consolidate powers, and the move was led by Saddam Hussein and his gang because he took over the internal security of the party. And eventually, that secret organization took over the country and got rid of, you know, al-Bekr.
The more he became totalitarian and dictator, the more you feel that this is not the same person I respected and I liked. It's a person who became blood hungry.
Gradually, we started hearing things. Like people disappearing, started attacking, you know, the communists, anybody who is against what he wants.
I'm Ali Adib. I'm an Iraqi reporter. I live here in Detroit. I moved from Baghdad in October 2007.
We're related from, you know, on my mother's side to the late minister, Dr. Riyad Brahim. He was health minister in, I think, in late 70s and early 80s. And we were very close, and I used to call him Ammo, you know, my uncle. Dr. Riyad was a Ba'athist, and he was very close to Bekr. So when Saddam took over, he just got rid of all the people who were close to Bekr. And we received a phone call. I was asleep, but I woke up. My mom was crying. And the phone call was simply saying that Dr. Riyad has gone to visit his parents. His parents were dead. So that was the code, because they know that people were listening to phone calls. We couldn't really show our grief because you wouldn't know who was with the government at that time, who was writing reports. Later on, when my mom went and visited, you know, she saw her uncle, who told her when they went to the morgue and they got the body and the uncle signed for it. He told us basically what he saw. The scene was horrible. They have taken off his nails. One of his eyes was gone, and you know, there were holes in his chest. And the death certificate said he died of a stroke. Okay. And it was one of the hundreds or thousands of tragic stories in Iraq.
It was an organized terror by the government. Nobody was safe in Iraq.
You can't even tell a joke. Sometimes, you know, I'm with friends and we are all sitting together laughing, and I say something like a joke. And then I go home, and I can't sleep all night waiting for the door. You know, the bell rings and somebody will come and take me. I left after Christmas 2002. I left to Amman, Jordan. I had chemotherapy, and my oncologist told me to leave the country because if I stayed, I wouldn't be able to continue my chemotherapy if the war starts.
2003
When I heard of the invasion, I was staying with friends and they were out. I just saw Baghdad burning. It was so sad It was the saddest day of my life. I was so sad. And I called my friends and I say, come back. They said, why? I said, Baghdad is burning.
They had a great military success. 2 weeks, country was gone. Great, but then what?
It was the biggest mistake that the U.S. had made to go and invade Iraq, because it put us in a situation that we have terrorists, we have drugs, we have fighting between religion sections. I mean, it's a mess over there now.
What you see here is a short clip of the hole where Saddam Hussein was found.
I remember the day he was caught, I was asleep here in Phoenix.
Spontaneously, we had a little party going, you know, like celebrating, you know, end of era of Saddam, he was arrested, and maybe things will happen better now.
But how do I describe it? It's a bitter feeling. It's like Iraqis should have caught Saddam. Iraqis should have tried him.
I was at work when they hanged Saddam Hussein. When I came home and I saw the video, it was a mixed feeling. A feeling that it's an end of era, that finally there will be no terrors and no crimes and no killing. But then it was also a sorry feeling for someone who for a while you were looking up to and felt that he's going to bring Iraq to the top of the whole world.
In 40 years of Saddam, there was no progress in Iraq. What's happening today is a result of the mistrust he built in the people, the separation he did to the people, led us to what we had now.
The psychological component of Iraqi person had changed. They are afraid, they are hesitant. And Iraqi people are the nicest, most generous people in the world. He changed them.
When somebody say, I wish Saddam is back, they say it out of desperation, out of hurt, not because they want Saddam back. I tell people, very simple, the difference between Saddam era and this era is hope. At Saddam time, we did not have hope.
Sometimes I feel hopeful that maybe, you know, things will change. I don't know. There is this thing that all Iraqis say, things change from worse to worse, and it did happen now. Saddam's gone and it changed. It's worse now.
That was Mona Suleiman, Leila Abdelghani, Nabil Rumaya, and Ali Adib Al-Naimi. Our series This Weekend in 1968 is produced by Ann Hepperman and Kara Oler. Production help this week from Ali Adib Al-Naimi. Special thanks to Hashim Altawil, Qasim Zagayer, Astrabuk, Daoud, Samir Al-Mandwi, and Farouk Salom. You can hear more stories from Iraqis about their memories of 1968, plus see photos and artwork on our website, weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week. And by Clarkson Potter, publishers of The Splendid Tables, How to Eat Supper, the latest cookbook inspired by the radio program for people who love to eat.
Coming up, housing bill or government bailout? Life is good or life is cruel? Good news, bad news, or no news? Next on Weekend America. From American Public Media, this is Weekend America. I'm Bill Radke with John Moe. Now that the hectic pace of the week has given way to the languid rhythms of the weekend, we can catch our breath and assess current events and ask ourselves whether they constituted good news, bad news, or really, in the big scheme of things, no news at all. Joining me are Red State writer Nancy French. Hi, Nancy.
Hi.
Blue State comedian Dana Gould. Hey, Dana.
Hello.
And elite ironic state essayist, in other words, New Yorker, David Rakoff. Hi, David.
Hello, Bill.
We don't understand your satirical ways down here.
Let me just take a sip of my martini.
Our first topic. Congress is passing a bill to help homeowners facing foreclosure and to shore up struggling mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. President Bush doesn't love it, but he won't veto it. Is the bill good news, bad news, or no news?
Well, it's good news if you're a homeowner, and it's bad news if you're a fan of the free market, because it's everything conservatives don't like. It's government intervention in the free market.
Nancy, is that true? Is that everything you don't like?
Well, it's pretty infuriating. I think it's bad news for taxpayers because we're being put on the hook for potentially hundreds of billions of dollars. I think it's necessary, probably, but it's like giving morphine to a cancer patient because it makes the pain temporarily go away. But we obviously have some underlying problems that need to be addressed. I don't know if it's the government's business to, you know, solve our financial woes personally. But, yeah, I think it's bad news.
David?
The only good news that I can see is that it might actually finally chip away at the Reaganite Republican myth of the wisdom of markets and actually show that the system that we have has always been capitalist at the bottom and socialist at the top. The one thing that it might help with is perhaps we won't be so high-handed in the way we tell other countries how best to handle their economies.
A lot of this stuff could have been avoided with very moderate common sense regulation. And I think that we're entering an era where that's going to, you know, there'll be some more regulation and then it will get abused and it'll strip it away and this will happen again. But fortunately, it'll happen to my kids, not me.
Our next topic. Government scientists announced this week that north of the Arctic Circle, deep in the ground, lies about 90 billion barrels of oil and a third of the world's undiscovered natural gas. Does that strike you as good news, bad news, or no news?
This seems to me to be no news, simply because, first of all, 90 billion barrels, you say, is at best 3 years' worth of fuel worldwide. So that's like mugging and killing someone for $12. Also, we've already got drilling facilities that we're not even remotely at capacity for, so we don't need to be drilling elsewhere. And sadly, you know, the main truth is we've got to stop with this oil.
Which eventually turns into usable oil after many, many years.
Precisely. Yeah, we can wait 5 billion years until we're all super compressed and turned into our own, you know, reserves.
One of the ways they were able to discover this was because the ice up there has melted away because of global warming, because of fossil fuel use.
Yeah.
So it's somewhat like, I was on my way to the food poisoning clinic and found the greatest burrito truck.
During the last energy summit, Saudi Arabia's oil minister said something I think that was pretty funny to the OPEC members who are increasingly becoming more greedy. He said, remember that the Stone Age didn't end because the cavemen ran out of stone.
Yes. And
I think it'd be great if we could kind of adapt and, you know, be independent.
So bad news, Nancy, for us to want to keep digging for oil in the north?
I think it's good news. I mean, it's kind of a security blanket. It's like finding a treasure, except instead of, you know, Harrison Ford looking for the Holy Grail, it's the U.S. Geological Survey who gets to have all the fun.
That's the first time I've heard of a oil platform in the middle of the tundra being described as fun for the U.S. Geological Survey.
I'm telling you, permafrost is where the fun begins.
Permafrost, vending machines, you know, lack of showers.
I'd like to know how we know that it's a third of the world's undiscovered natural gas. I know that makes sense to many smart people.
That gas was previously thought to have been in Ernest Borgnine.
Our final topic. This economy is brutal. Gas prices are painful. There's war and disease, but a hot-selling T-shirt declares life is good. This summer, there are Life is Good festivals across the country. There's one this weekend in Ridgefield, Connecticut. Call it a fad, call it a movement. Is it good news, bad news, or no news?
The Life is Good mascot is a stick figure with a smiling face. This is the same stick figure they use when they give you, like, signs in hotels. Like when they have, like, the fire escape sign.
Mm, yes.
And they show this stick figure calmly walking down the stairs. And as my very good friend from Boston, Bill Broaddus, once noted, in a fire, the last person who is going to be walking calmly is a guy made of sticks.
Let's see.
So I never trust that stick figure. He's always lying.
Okay. Bad news, Dana says. Others?
I agree wholeheartedly. It's just, it's hateful, hateful, hateful news. It's craven marketing. It couldn't be more intellectually dishonest of, you know, conflating a product line with some higher consciousness. It's completely disgusting. And I thought it was interesting that Bert Jacobs, the owner of the company, said, "The people who face the most adversity are the ones who embrace life is good the most." And I thought, well, if you replace the word embrace with manufacture at near slave wages, then he's kind of right. But it's absolutely disgusting to me.
Well, as Americans, we have great lives. But the T-shirts cost $25. And people who can buy $25 T-shirts that has pictures of the stick figure canoeing and boating and playing golf. It's like life is good for people who have life of leisure.
But people, now the message of the shirt, though, the makers, is that you can be happy not because of your circumstances, but just because life is good.
Well, I prefer Stonewall Jackson's creed. He said something like, "My religion teaches me that I'm as safe in the bed as I am on the battlefield," because he believed in the providence of God.
That's also Michael Jackson's creed.
Yes, it is. Okay, so someone who owns this shirt and says, "It reminds me that things aren't so bad and I feel better." That feeling better, you got a problem with that?
You know, it would actually not be a problem for me if he or she put a free rubber band that came around his broccoli around his wrist.
Mm.
And every time he snaps it, he remembers that life is not as bad as it is.
Yeah, and it's not true. I mean, anyone who lives life for longer than a few weeks realizes that it's not constantly good. And so you have to kind of develop a philosophy that deals with pain.
I think it was Camus who said, "Though we must live in a world where children suffer, perhaps we can reduce the number of children who suffer." But children still suffer. So life is not innately good.
My guests have been Albert Camus, Immanuel Kant, and Soren Kierkegaard. That's the news this week. Panel, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Bill.
Thanks, Bill.
Good night, John Boy.
In truth, that was comedian Dana Gould, whose credits include The Simpsons, Nancy French, the author of A Red State of Mind, How a Catfish Queen Reject Became a Liberty Bell, and David Rakoff's latest book is Don't Get Too Comfortable, The Indignities of Coach Class, The Torments of Low Thread Count, The Never-Ending Quest for Artisanal Olive Oil, and Other First World Problems.
Weekend America is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. This program is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, and KPCC Los Angeles.
Climate change has an effect on all parts of the world, but you notice global warming a bit more when you're in Glacier National Park, ahead on Weekend America.
From American Public Media, this is Weekend America. I'm John Moe with Bill Radke. More than 30 million people in the United States go fishing every year. Kick back, wait for a nibble. It's very relaxing, unless something goes horribly wrong.
We've seen fish hooks that have been stuck in somebody's hand and in the leg at the same time. So they kind of come walking in with their hand on their thigh, wondering how to get rid of this fish hook that somehow has managed to get them in two body locations.
Dr. Tom Edwards works the emergency room in Alexandria, Minnesota, an area surrounded by 247 lakes. Right now is the height of fishing season, and I guarantee you, Bill, more than one angler will end up in Dr. Edwards' care this weekend. There's no doubt about it. Jim Gates paid him a visit.
The Douglas County Emergency Room isn't like one of those chaotic, noisy ER rooms you might see in a big city, at least not on this Friday afternoon. Dr. Edwards and the nurses are sitting around, waiting for something to happen. Then Chris Smith walks in. He's got a yellow fishing lure dangling from his right index finger.
I'm going to have you lie down on the bed here just because your hand will be lying flat against the bed and we can kind of rely on it not moving when we remove the hook.
Chris is a big stoic guy. He came up from Minneapolis. While he was fishing on Lake Melitona, he got a bite on his line and reeled in a rock bass.
Just a freak. Was in the process of taking the hook out, and the fish flopped and kind of fell out of my hand, and the hook that the fish wasn't on, that's the one that's in my hand now. So
Chris lays his hand on the side of the gurney, and Dr. Edwards pulls out his fish hook removal box. Inside are bandages, string, pliers, syringes. Then the doctor injects Chris's finger with a local anesthetic.
Now what I'd like you to do is just hold your hand real steady, and we're going to flip it out. Okay. And we got it out.
Just like that, it pops out. Chris doesn't even flinch.
And we got a little bit of bleeding, but nothing too bad. We should probably clean it up a little bit. Yeah, that was pretty embedded.
There are four ways to remove a fish hook. The back-out method, the push-through method, the needle technique, and the string technique. Dr. Edwards prefers the string technique. He ties a string to the hook, angles it just right, and then flicks it out. But sometimes it's not just the hook that he has to deal with.
Probably the first thing to do is to remove the fish from the hook, which is stuck in the person's arm.
You've actually had fish
we actually
stuck on the hook?
We come in with a bass that was very, very much dead, and the fish hook in the person's hand and the other end still in the bass.
He's seen fish hooks in hands and shoulders, eyelids, ears, and
a nose?
The nostrils hooked into the in the both sides.
That's Nurse Don. He assists Dr. Edwards in the ER.
How'd you get that out?
We pushed the one through on the outside and clipped it and then backed it back through and then just lifted it out of the septum.
Ugh. Over the three-month fishing season, they'll remove anywhere from 50 to 100 hooks. So far this summer, they've removed 26. Dr. Edwards recommends getting a tetanus shot if you haven't had one in the last 5 years. After a hook is removed, the victim is introduced to a special friend.
Well, this is Mr. Freshwater Ferdy, and Freshwater has a unique standing in the community because he knows a lot of different people that have had the unfortunate occasion of meeting him.
Freshwater Ferdy is a large, almost life-sized, crude drawing of a smiling fisherman that hangs on the bathroom door. He's got a blue hat, red vest, pinstripe pants. Every season, the nurses retrace the drawing, color it in, and give it a new name. Wally Walleye, Patty Pike, Trapper Don. The doctors mark on him where they've removed each fish hook, sort of like a cartoon stat sheet.
Index finger number would be like right about there, I guess.
Dr. Edwards takes a pen and marks an X on Ferdy's right index finger to show where Chris Smith was injured. Fish hook victim number 27.
I think it makes people realize that it's, you know, it's actually a little more funnier than what they think. And when they walk out, I think they almost all walk out with a big smile on their face because now they've got their... They've been recorded in history now for the county of where they had their fish hook.
On Freshwater Ferdy.
On Freshwater Ferdy.
In Alexandria, Minnesota, I'm Jim Gates for Weekend America.
We have photos of Chris Smith and his errant hook, and if you can stand it, we have a video on how to remove a fish hook. That's about as pleasant as you can imagine it is. That's at our website, weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
I'm Bill Radke, along with John Moe. It's late July, and for America's national parks, it's high season. As part of our summer travel series, we take you now deep into one of the most majestic of these wild areas, Glacier National Park. The last ice age carved steep slopes and lake-filled valleys into the Rocky Mountains. The effect is spectacular, and the park opened in 1910. That's when the Great Northern Railway made its pitch to wealthy Americans. Forget visiting Europe by boat. Ride the rail and experience the grandeur of the American West. The railroad developed Glacier National Park with Swiss-looking chalets that are still there. Originally, the sightseeing was by horseback. Today, the park is open to cars. And if you want to get away from the crowds, you'll need to use your legs. Reporter Michael May takes us on a six-day hike through the glacier backcountry.
Swift Current Pass rises sharply from Going to the Sun Road, a winding highway that slithers along the edge of a deep valley in the center of Glacier National Park. My wife Rachel and I will walk 50 miles and cross three mountain passes before we see asphalt again. From the car, the mountains look impossibly steep and majestic. From the tree-covered trails, they just look impossibly steep.
So I've been hiking for about a mile or so, and we're going pretty much straight up, and we'll be camping tonight in snow. Just hard to believe, just a few miles up this trail, straight up this trail. So.
That's right, snow. Montana had record snowfalls in June this year, and the mountains still sparkle under the hot July sun. The trail starts with a merciless 2,000-foot climb through pine forests and mountain meadows. I begin to wonder why I put myself through this strain. After several hours of hiking, the wildflowers give way to snowfields. Finally, we come across a sign for our campground.
Is that for real? There's...
Yeah.
We just came on a sign that says Granite Park Campground, 0.6 miles. And it's just pointing directly into a forest covered with snow.
There was no trail, so we headed blindly into the woods. About 20 minutes later, we come across a sign sticking out of the snow. We have Granite Park campsite all to ourselves. A rushing creek cuts through the snow. I cross it and walk to a clearing above the trees. And I immediately forget about the hours of slogging up switchbacks. The valley below unfolds in shadows. Snow-capped granite peaks rise into the purple sky. I now understand why the park is called the Crown of the Continent. I find a rock and sit for hours, exhausted, mesmerized.
It's very odd. I'm sitting here in snow, being bitten by mosquitoes. They will not leave me alone. They are hungry.
The next morning, we hike over the Continental Divide at Swift Current Pass. On the other side, we celebrate the joy of going downhill by boot skiing down a snowfield several hundred feet long. You can still see glaciers on both sides of the trail. They're hardly the mammoth chunks of ice that carved the valleys below and whittled the mountaintops into spire-like horns and tall, thin ridges. We pass Swift Current Glacier. Photos from the 1930s show it filling a hollow bowl in the mountain. Now it's shrunk by a third. Mountain glaciers are one of the best measures of climate change because, unlike plants or animals, they have only one response to rising temperatures. They shrink. Due to global warming, the last glaciers in the park are expected to melt away in 12 years. Our next night, we camp at what is still called Many Glacier Valley. We share a campsite with two teenagers on a cross-country trip.
I'm out here to get away from my mom and self-discovery. I don't know what I want to do with my life or myself, so I don't have a reason. I thought I'd come out here and find one.
Christina Bavinet is 19 years old and has never backpacked before. Their first day involved a 14-mile hike over a snowy pass. Christina slipped and started to slide down the mountain.
I could not stop. So then I just started worrying about what was going to happen when I got to the bottom of it.
Thankfully, there was trees at the bottom, not a cliff. She made it back to the trail and eventually back to the campsite.
The first thing I did was cry, and then I just wanted my mommy. That was it. And then ever since, I called my mom that night and told her I loved her and that I couldn't wait to come home.
Christina and her friend called off the rest of their hike. The wilderness had taught her something she needed to know, even if it hadn't been what she'd expected to learn. I think that happens to every hiker in one way or another. There's a romanticism to backpacking that can obscure its more painful and grueling aspects. I spend much more time recalling the sweeping views than the way I felt going up the passes. By the third day on the trail, I'm used to walking for hours. The rhythm of my steps becomes a sort of hypnotic tonic. I'm aware of the sounds around me, and my mind wanders aimlessly. My wife Rachel is a policy wonk for an Austin City Council member. She needs to get away to feel like this.
I like being completely disconnected from your regular life so that there's no chance of checking back in. And there's no... You make all your decisions ahead of time, and so you just go. And there's nothing to decide other than, should we have the Kathmandu curry or the beans and rice? Hey, bear!
There are three main dangers in Glacier: falling off a cliff, drowning, and having a bad encounter with a grizzly bear.
Yo! Bear!
The park is home to around 300 of them. Grizzlies can weigh 1,000 pounds and are much more aggressive than black bears.
Don't test me!
It's a bad idea to surprise a grizzly, so we make a lot of noise as we walk along.
I know kung fu!
The grizzlies force Glacier hikers to get friendly. You need a permit for each campground, and there's a shared kitchen area so that food smells stay far away from the tents. No one wants to wake up to a blur of fur and teeth searching for a midnight snack. So when we arrive at camp, we sit around our portable gas stoves with our fellow backpackers. A typical conversation? The best freeze-dried food, of course.
I haven't had one
we'll
yet.
We'll let you know.
Oh, really?
There's an immediate intimacy among strangers cooking together in the wilderness. We meet parents who come out here with their children to get away from PlayStations and cell phones. Tonight, there's 8 firefighters here. Our next day is our longest and hardest hike, 14 miles with a 3,000-foot climb over a pass. Glacier lies where many of North America's ecosystems meet. Arctic, Pacific, the Great Plains, the Central Rockies. Plants and animals from all these environments find a home here. Deer among wildflower meadows, a bull moose grazing near shimmering Poya Lake, bighorn sheep and mountain goats scaling impossible granite precipices high above the tree line. And then, just ahead of us, Rachel gasps, a bear.
It wasn't very big, so I worry that it's a cub and that there's a mother around, so we'll just hang out.
It was a black bear, and I didn't catch a glimpse. I was a bit relieved, but also disappointed.
I, like, went around a corner, and it was, like, 20 feet away, and it was just, this, like, it just jumped and took off.
We regrouped, ramped up our bear calls, and headed back down the trail. We had another 18 miles to reach our car. The bear could stay, but we are just passing through. In Glacier National Park, I'm Michael May for Weekend America.
We love you, bear!
A capacious definition of love there. Michael brought back some gorgeous photographs. We have a slideshow for you at weekendamerica.org. Thank you. The Beijing Olympics are right around the corner, and so are the Paralympics, also held in Beijing. American Paralympic powerlifter Mary Stack is getting ready. She's lifting, she's eating right, and she's honing her playlist.
For me, learning how to focus was not an easy task. I started by closing my eyes. That just wasn't working. So I ended up starting to use music to focus, and that's really worked well for me. If I'm focused, I'll medal. That's just how it goes. I'll be the first woman in the U.S. to medal at the Paralympics for powerlifting. So that's something to, that's my goal.
Going for the medal there, that's Paralympian powerlifter Mary Stack. Okay, she focuses with Metallica. What about you? What music helps you blank out all the noise and concentrate on the task at hand? Whether that's painting, driving, serving others, who knows? Let us in on your music, and we'll put together the Weekend America Get Focused listener playlist. Give us your song at weekendamerica.org.
Well, if you are in South Dakota or Nebraska, hold on tight. Severe thunderstorms in the forecast for today. Let's take a look at some weather and some fun around other parts of the country. Mosquitoes are a nuisance, unless they include Texas, in which case they are celebrities and a nuisance. 93 and cloudy for the Great Texas Mosquito Festival with a fun run and mosquito calling contest. Also arm slapping, but that's more of an informal event. Refreshments include burgers for humans, humans for mosquitoes. I scream, you scream, Erie, Pennsylvania screams for ice cream. The minor league Erie Sea Wolves host 180 feet of ice cream day with massive troughs lining the first and third base lines after the game, topped with thunder and lightning and 79 degrees. Also, presumably chalk and some dirt, maybe tobacco juice, some bubble gum. I'm not hungry anymore. Partly cloudy in Wellington, Kansas, and 99 degrees, and 13 legs of racing, that is. They call it the Great Race, as teams compete in a relay that makes other relays feel like they're barely even relays. There's running, biking, canoeing, horse riding, nine other legs, and a railroad spike is passed between the team members. It's for people who love sports but hate attention spans. For more information on these and other events, go to weekendamerica.org. With a little bit of weather everywhere, I'm John Moe for Weekend America.
Coming up, the U.S. Army acknowledges a 60-year-old mistake. What kind of apology could be enough? That's next on Weekend America.
Weekend America is supported by Gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. People are talking about their weekends at Gather.com.
From American Public Media, this is Weekend America. I'm Bill Radke with John Moe. This weekend, the U.S. military is revisiting a grim piece of American history at a former military fort in Seattle. A riot there during World War II led to the only time in history when black Americans stood trial for lynching a white man. Several families of the accused men will visit the old Fort Lawton this weekend for the first time. They'll see a place that has haunted their family histories for more than 60 years. Reporter Liz Jones has our story.
Growing up in Milwaukee, Lachelle Drake spent a lot of time with her grandfather. They were close. He liked to talk. But one thing he never talked about was World War II. Lachelle learned that early on.
I recall once when I came home from school and I was doing a report
I said, Grandpa, weren't you in the war? Then my grandmother said, shh, no, 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 honey, no, no. We don't do that. Come here, come here. I saw his entire demeanor change.
Lachelle calls those her grandfather's quiet moments. They stood out because her grandfather, Booker Townsell, was someone whose personality filled the room. He raised his children and grandchildren to be proud, to be fighters.
He wanted us to sit up straight. He wanted us to look people in the eye. He never wanted us to have bad posture, stand up straight. I think he wanted us to fight our own battles because that was taken away from him.
The battle Townsell couldn't fight was for his own innocence. It began during World War II when he was stationed at Fort Lawton in Seattle. One night, an Italian prisoner of war named Guglielmo Olivotto was found lynched. Townsell was accused in connection with his death, and in a rushed military trial, the Army found him guilty of rioting. He was dishonorably discharged and served 2 years in prison. The story would have probably ended there if not for Seattle journalist Jack Hammond. He recently wrote a book that re-examined the 60-year-old case. We meet at the former fort and walk down a shady path past a sprawling 100-year-old maple.
And you know, without any question, that that tree was definitely here.
Only the trees could talk, huh?
Oh, yeah, that tree saw it all.
We approach what used to be the Fort Segregated Black Barracks. Italian POWs were housed nearby. Hammond unravels how the conflict started that night. Four Italian soldiers were returning from a night out drinking. Four black soldiers were walking up the path the opposite way. Many of them had also been drinking. Insults started to fly back and forth. Then it came to blows.
And within just a few moments, there were laid out three different African-American soldiers, with a fourth one down here, all bleeding, and one who, the rumor went out incorrectly, looked for all the world like he might even be dead. That's when the black soldiers here said, oh my gosh, we're under attack.
A riot broke out between hundreds of black and Italian soldiers. The next morning, the Italian soldier was found hanging on wires below a wooded bluff. Townsell and 42 other black soldiers stood trial in connection with the lynching. More than half were found guilty of rioting. Two were also convicted of manslaughter. But a few years ago, Hammond found a key document that rewrote this piece of history. It was a previously top-secret report written by a high-ranking Army general.
It all started to make sense. He saw, really, the truth, but the truth was, at that time, classified.
The general's report raised questions about the role of a white military policeman during the riot. Relations were tense between white and Italian soldiers, mainly because they were courting the same American women. The report points to the white MP, not just the black soldiers, as a possible suspect. What's more, the 43 defendants had only been given two lawyers and 10 days to prepare their case. It appeared some men were accused merely because they had the same first name as someone else, and the prosecution suppressed key evidence that could have helped the soldiers. Last year, the Army ruled the trial was flawed and unfair. All the convictions were overturned and the dishonorable discharges reversed.
Now it all makes sense that this was something that he was carrying on his heart very heavy, and he carried it with him to his grave.
Lachelle Drake might never have known all this, but one day a few years ago, her cousin randomly did a Google search on her grandfather's name and found Hammond's research. Lachelle pored over a binder full of documents he'd gathered. She remembers sitting in her mother's kitchen reading her grandfather's court testimony. A prosecutor was grilling him about where he was the night of the lynching.
I recall the prosecutor asking, well, what would you say if we were to tell you that this one soldier said that you were there? Well, I would tell you that that person is lying. Well, what if we were to tell you that two other people saw you there? Well, I would tell you that they were lying, too. I have witnesses. And he told him that he was lying. And my grandfather said, I beg your pardon. and I can just see his face. I beg your pardon.
Last year, the Army gave Booker Townsell a military burial, his honorable discharge, and an apology. He'd passed away 25 years before. Like Lachelle's grandfather, most of the 43 defendants have died. Only two are still alive. Of the others, just 10 of their families have been located. Lachelle has connected with most of them. She calls and emails, and she'll finally meet several in person this weekend at a tribute in Seattle. She'll continue to help find the other families, the ones who still don't know about this missing piece of their history. She wants them to have what her family now has, the truth.
There is a completion. There's wholeness. There's healing. There's been restoration. Just in knowing the complete person. Pieces of the puzzles that we didn't have of their lives have now been filled.
In Seattle, I'm Liz Jones for Weekend America.
Seattle is hosting a tribute this weekend to restore military honors to the Fort Lawton veterans. Last year, Congress authorized back pay for the exonerated soldiers, but those payments left off interest and adjustments for inflation. Another bill is pending in Congress that would make up the difference. We have photos of Lachelle and Fort Lawton and her grandfather in uniform at weekendamerica.org. And that's it for another hour of American Public Media's Weekend America, produced by Ben Adair, Julia Barton, who this weekend is deciding between home repair and a beach trip, Millie Jefferson, Sasha Aslanian, E. Okobi, Philip Stern, Sam Keenan, Michael Rayfield, Lori Selleck, Rob Byers, he's racing his bike and helping a friend find a new one, and Angela Kim.
Also Tim Bamba, Susie Lechtenberg, Christina Pena, Chrissy Clark, Brendan Noonan, Michael May, who's choosing not to hike through the mountains this weekend. He figures he'll watch some TV instead. Ocean Kalen, Phyllis Owens, and Mark Sanchez, who's testing the personal limits of his capacity for bratwurst consumption.
Galactic created our theme music. Executive producer is Peter Clowney. Jim Russell created the show. You can get a free podcast of it at weekendamerica.org. I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm John Moe. Get out and enjoy your weekend.
This program is made possible with support from AIR, the Association of Independence in Radio, and public radio stations including WMFE Orlando, KUOW Seattle, and KNOW St. Paul, and made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by
American Public Media.
Hi, this is Desiree Cooper, co-host of Weekend America. This weekend in 1968, America sang along. Nixon's the only one. We believe in Nixon. All this year, we're looking back at This Weekend in 1968 and why it still matters today. Join us on Weekend America.